Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 127 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Mike, and that is Gavin. And Gavin, where are you going to be spending your holidays?
I'm going to be heading up to New York to see my family, just like we did last year. Fortunately for me, because I'm the one that does the driving between myself and Liz, there's not going to be a giant snowstorm this year like there was last year.
That was rough last year.
Yeah, we got about 4 feet of snow just over like the weekend of Christmas. So like over 48 hours, we had about 4 feet of snow in my parents' yard. And Liz loved it because she's not had a white Christmas in a very long time. Her mom's family's from Michigan.
Living in California, I bet.
Yeah. But yeah, her mom is from Michigan. So she would, when she was a kid, you know, go and spend Christmas up there. But it had been a long time since they'd done that. After the initial sort of freak out of like, what happens when the power goes out? Do we have enough food? Like, what happens when we can't go anywhere? And it's funny because Liz and my mom actually ended up getting COVID that weekend anyway, or I guess they got it the weekend before. And then my mom called me as we were 4 hours into our 5 hour drive with this giant storm coming through. And mom was like, "Hey, I tested positive." And we were like, "Well, shoot, what do we do?" And it was also relatively late, so we couldn't just turn around, you know?
Right.
So we got to my parents' house, and we both took a COVID test, and we figured, well, if one of us is positive, we might as well both be positive. And Liz tested positive, so we just stayed, you know, the whole weekend with my parents, which we would have done anyway, but we didn't get to see, like, my sister or my nieces and stuff. But, yeah, we couldn't go anywhere anyway because of the snow, so it really didn't affect our Christmas at all.
Which is, I guess, convenient.
Yeah.
Because we're all going to get it at some point, so, or have already gotten it.
Yeah. But yeah, so this year there's forecast to be no snow at all. It's supposed to be like 50 degrees on Christmas Day, so Liz is a little bummed because she enjoys having, you know, a white Christmas. But
right.
Yeah, so that's what we're doing. And then for New Year's, my parents are actually coming down here to deliver one of their Christmas presents, and also just to help us with a couple of things around the house. Like, as much as I think that I'm a relatively handy person, my dad is much better at that kind of stuff.
Right.
So he's going to show me, you know, how to put in like an outlet somewhere, or just help me with, you know, that kind of stuff. That, you know, YouTube is only so helpful. It's very helpful, but you know, only so helpful for that kind of stuff.
Right.
So. But yeah,
helpful,
what about
but
you?
Only so helpful.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I live on the exact same street as my parents do.
Oh, I didn't know that.
We've always had Christmas. Oh, yeah, we've always had Christmas at my parents' house growing up. So yeah. I can just walk on down the street, and I can hang out with mostly the Italian side of the family. And then whenever I'm ready, I get to activate the Irish part of my family and just leave.
And just leave.
And not tell anybody.
Exactly.
It is fantastic for anybody here that does not use the Irish goodbye in your daily life.
It's
I mean,
so
I don't
good.
Know what you're doing.
It's so good. All of my friends from grad school were very Midwestern. So like I had one friend who was from New Jersey, but the rest were from like Minnesota, Kansas, you know, places like that, who are just very nice and very polite. And then right. there's just me, the New Yorker, and then the New Jersian. And we would just be like, all right, see you guys next week. Bye. And then we'd just leave. Meanwhile, the Minnesotans would still be there 20, 30 minutes after being like, all right, I should probably get going. And they'd still just be standing in the doorway, coat on, boots on, still just talking 20 minutes after they were supposed to leave. And I'm like, I hate that. I'm just going to go.
Everything about it. yeah, it is absolutely the, like, all right, we got to say goodbye to everybody 9,000 times. It's not for me. So yeah. It's not me being rude. Well, it is me being rude a little bit. But
A little bit, but it is what it is.
Well, I'm okay with that. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, also, we haven't said this yet. Fia's not with us today. She is traveling for the holidays. She is, her and her boyfriend are driving from Florida to spend it with his family in Louisiana. So she's traveling. She's having a good time. So all the best to Fia. But it's harder when you're traveling across multiple states, whereas I just have to move, you know, one state and Mike just has to walk. So,
yep.
Yeah, Sophia will be back with us next episode. But in the meantime, I guess I'll do some of the housekeeping for today.
Please do, because I have no idea what I'd even say.
Yeah. See, so don't forget to rate the show on whatever platform you listen to us on, and make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, etc. to give us feedback on the show and suggest any future topics you'd like to hear on the podcast. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, make sure to fill out the guest form down below in the show notes. And as for what we're talking about next episode, I don't really know. I'm trying to line up a guest episode, so we'll see if that pans out. If not, I will come up with something else.
Noted.
Cool beans. So, Mike told me that he was coming up, or having trouble coming up with Today in History, because around Christmas time, the world just kind of slows down. So what do you got for us, Mike?
Well, I'm cheating, because one of the coolest things in American history happened on December 26th. So I'm just making the executive decision that we're going with December 26th. In 1776, George Washington led U.S. troops to defeat the Hessians at the Battle of Trenton. That's where that famous painting of Washington crossing the Delaware comes from. The painting itself is not particularly accurate, but most of the details of the battle are. The Hessians were surprised on Christmas. I think the rumor of them being too drunk to fight is, I believe, just that, a rumor, but...
Yeah, I think it's just still, more that they didn't expect it because it was Christmas time.
And which is still just plenty good enough for me as a cool thing that happened.
What heathens would do war on this holiday?
Americans, that's who.
That's right.
Damn right.
But cool, that's a cool one. I knew it was around this time of year, but I definitely didn't know the actual day.
Yeah, December 26th. That's always a fun thing to go over with my 7th graders when I'm teaching them that. So, so that's Today in History. All right, Gavin, what are we learning about today?
Yeah, so today we are talking about herbivores and what it takes to eat plants, because surprisingly, it is really hard to eat plants full-time, which might come as kind of a surprise to people, because all the herbivores, the plant-eating animals in the environment are always kind of, A, generally the less interesting ones, and B, sometimes it's kind of seen as like the background, even when you learn about it in sort of elementary school science, you know,
right.
It's just like they eat the plants and then the carnivores, who are the interesting ones, eat the herbivores. And it makes for good action shots of them hunting their prey and stuff. Whereas, you know, a gazelle eating grass is not particularly action-y.
Right. Especially when you're a kid, it's just, you know, eating a steak is, you know, more exciting than eating salad.
Yeah, for sure. So herbivores, like I said, as you learn, a lot of this is going to be like, you know, second, third grade science, you know, ecosystem sort of level stuff. Herbivores are sort of the foundation of at least terrestrial ecosystems. Marine ecosystems get a little funky when it comes to herbivory, quote unquote, because in a lot of marine environments, there are technically not herbs to vor. So herbivory in those situations is a little tricky. There's lots of different official, you know, definitions of an herbivore, but it more or less is exactly what you think. It's an animal that gets the vast majority of its calories from plants or algae. There are no animals that get 100% of their calories this way, as we sort of mentioned here and there on the podcast before. For example, if a cow is just out in a field eating grass, they're just naturally going to eat some bugs and stuff on the grass as well. That's just sort of going to happen by accident. Or sometimes they'll go out of their way to eat very small animals. For example, if you look on YouTube, you can very easily find clips of a deer or a horse or a cow eating like a baby chicken whole, just like snapping it right up. They do that on purpose, because A, it's just really easy. You know, what's it gonna do?
well, yeah.
And, protein is protein, you know, herbivores need protein, you know, just as much as something that eats meat does. And plants,
they still got to get those gains.
Exactly. So plants generally have much less protein, you know, ounce per, you know, for ounce than, you know, meat does, or just a whole animal does. On top of things like calcium, which especially female mammals or female reptiles really need the extra calcium for producing milk in the case of mammals, or producing eggs in the case of reptiles. So everything is an herbivore until occasionally it's not. So that's why it's, you know, just an animal that gets the majority, the vast majority of its calories from plants.
It seems like a lot of those, like, yeah, non-plant calories are almost a mistake. Like, that's
a lot,
like,
of them, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's see, and like I said, think back to, like, first grade science. All life on Earth gets its energy from the sun, with an asterisk. There's, like, deep sea vent stuff going on that does chemicals from the Earth's deep inside the Earth. But by and large, life on Earth gets its energy from the sun. The plants take in the sun's energy to produce sugar. That's photosynthesis. Then the herbivores eat the plants. Then the carnivores eat the herbivores. Again, more complicated, particularly in the oceans, a bit more complicated. But when we take a look at how herbivory evolved toward the end of the episode, we'll get more in-depth on that kind of stuff. But because herbivores are sort of the bottom of the food chain, more or less, it can be somewhat natural assumption that they are more simple. And if you take that step, you know, that logic a bit further, it can sort of seem that herbivory is sort of the default setting for mammals, because it's the more direct way to get that energy from the sun. You know, each time, if you think of like a food pyramid, not the like nutrition one, but like an ecosystem pyramid, each time you go up a level, you only get about 10% of the energy from the level below you. So
I've seen that before. Yeah. Like, why is that? Why is it a pretty consistent 10% across the board? Like, that
it seems varies. Like
one of those things that should.
Yeah. It varies tremendously. Very wildly.
Okay. Yeah. So that's more of a rule of thumb than an actual rule.
Right. It also depends a lot on, like, for example, reptiles are just much more efficient at converting calories eaten into actual body mass, because they don't have this pesky habit of producing all of the heat that they need to run their bodies, whereas mammals and birds are wildly inefficient because we burn so much of our calories just to keep our body temperature up.
Right.
So, again, it varies, and then it's also even weirder when you get into things like insects and things like that that are also, by and large, ectothermic and don't make their own heat. But their metabolisms work just fundamentally differently than vertebrate, you know, metabolisms do. But yeah, so that is another sort of inherent thing that I didn't really see this anywhere, but this is just something that I thought about in my own sort of musings as I was, you know, doing some background research for this episode, is that's also kind of how it went for human evolution, where to think of things like other apes. As we you know, we've talked about human evolution pretty recently on the show. All of our ape ancestors, and even our, you know, currently still living ape relatives like chimps and gorillas, they by and large eat, you know, almost all plants, particularly gorillas. Chimps and bonobos tend to do a little bit of hunting, so they're more omnivorous, but still get the majority of their calories from plants. But over time, humans have developed to become omnivorous, and that's why we're actually able to eat both comfortably and as a significant part of our diet. So that's just sort of something that I kind of thought of in my head, is that, yeah, it seems like, you know, the default is herbivory because that sort of was our default before we, you know, became humans. However, that's definitely not the case in the broader animal kingdom. And if you had to take a gander, Mike, at why herbivory is generally harder than eating meat. Why would you think that is?
Why? Say that one more time.
So, just like, what? Why would you think that eating plants is generally harder than eating meat? Like, a harder of a lifestyle to make a living out of.
Okay, so... So, the answer here is, I don't know.
Right.
I'm going to make something up here. Sure. We're gonna have fun here. I'm going to make this up. I'm going to assume that there is just, like, something chemically different. Like, taking, you know, plants and leafy greens and converting them into, like, you know, protein and muscle and things in the body. And if that's already been done for you by some other animal, then, like, just that chemical process doesn't need to take place. Versus if you're eating, you know, all plants, it is, there is just more of a chemical process that needs to take place before your body can actually use, you know, what you've eaten as fuel. That's all I got. I don't have a clue.
No, I mean, that's, you know, pretty much spot on. So the biggest thing,
if I got that right,
the biggest thing is that the animal body already has the tools it needs to break down animal tissues, because your body does that all the time anyway.
Right.
Your own body is constantly breaking down your cells and replacing them as they get older. That's, you know, how your body naturally prevents cancer from happening, because you are, whether you know it or not, you are constantly getting cancer inside your body. But your immune system is typically pretty good at finding that, breaking that cell down, and then reusing all of those proteins and things. So your body already naturally has the enzymes and other proteins that are used to break down animal tissue by default. That's just part of being a living animal. Whereas, because plants use different sort of building blocks, we don't inherently have the enzymes that match up with those plant building blocks to break those down. So it's,
I mean, it makes sense, I guess, just like, you know, the actual chemistry, I assume, is like vastly more complicated, but
see, it really isn't. On a molecular level, yeah, sure. But like, I remember being even in college and doing sort of exercises with enzymes where it's just like a block with a certain shape. Because that's all enzymes are. It's just a protein that is a certain shape that fits with another thing. And then, you know, the enzyme is really only good for a very small range of proteins or other materials to get broken down. And something fits in the slot of the enzyme, and the enzyme just pulls it apart and does its job and moves on to the next one. So chemically, yeah, there are different, you know, bonds being, chemical bonds being broken and stuff like that. But from a layperson's perspective, it really is just as simple as, you know, it fits in this block and gets broken up, and that's kind of it. Whereas the plant stuff doesn't fit in the block and can't be broken up. And you can even sort of see this in, if you look at some of the most simple animals, those being things like corals, jellies, sea anemones, stuff like that. They're all carnivorous. Corals, you know, that might surprise some people, because you always think of corals as doing photosynthesis, but it's not actually the animal that does photosynthesis. The actual coral animal looks like a sea anemone, just really, really tiny. And so they're constantly grabbing stuff out of the water, like little, like fish poop, or just like fish, like skin cells that they also shed just kind of in the water, stuff like that. They're constantly grabbing those out of the water to eat. And so the coral animal itself, you know, they are micro carnivores. And so if you look at just the most simple, most basic animals, they are all carnivorous. That is sort of the default for all animals. Let's see. And it's again, getting more complicated in the water, because there's just animal material floating around literally everywhere. That's just kind of microscopic. And it's not all animal material per se. Things like protists or protozoans that have animal-like cells, but are not animals, just like amoebas and stuff like that. They can pluck out of the water as well. Anything that doesn't have like a cell wall like a plant, I'm sort of counting okay. as animal, you know, material.
Right.
And animal cells also, if you look at just like, you know, probably by this point, middle to high school biology, if you remember seeing an animal cell next to a plant cell, the animal cell is just kind of like a blob. Just kind of like a roughly sphere-shaped, just a generic animal cell, without too much structure to it. There is, but it's not nearly as strong as a plant cell, which mostly you've probably seen as like this rectangle that's like very neatly shaped, because it has that pretty tough cell wall around it, made up mostly of a material called cellulose. And that's really the thing that makes it hard to be an herbivore, is cellulose, because there are very few animals at all that have the natural ability to break down cellulose. There are a couple. To my knowledge, no vertebrates have the ability to break down cellulose by themselves at all.
Really?
Yeah. There's a couple things like different insects. We'll talk about that a bit more later down. So I won't spoil it too much yet.
Okay.
But, you know, the reason why plants have this is because plants don't really have, like, a skeleton. So they need something to give themselves structure. If you think of, like, a blade of grass, it's not just, like, laying on the ground like a wet noodle or something. So this cellulose and another compound in the cell wall called lignin, they give the plant cells structure. So plants generally are held up sort of, like, on a cellular basis, not with, like, a skeleton and on the inside, like a vertebrae, or even on the outside, necessarily like a like an insect or something. So they're held up on like a cell by cell basis, which is actually really cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, so again, it's these two compounds, mostly cellulose, but also lignin, that make it hard. However, obviously, we still have animals that are herbivores. So what are some of the ways that they get around, you know, this problem, really? Because if you can't get through the cell wall, then you can't get to the actually digestible stuff that's inside the cell. So let's go through some...
I assume you're telling me something about enzymes?
Yes, sort of.
Okay.
Less science-y than that. So, the most famous group of animals for doing this are a group of animals called the ruminants, which include... some very familiar animals. These would be your goats, your sheep, cows, deer, giraffes. These are the kind that you'll hear have multiple stomachs. If you've ever heard, okay. like, a cow has, like, four or five stomachs, if you've heard that before.
Right.
That's really not quite true. It is all just one stomach. It's sort of just, like, in different chambers, like your heart sort of is. So you wouldn't say okay. you have four hearts. You would just say your heart has four chambers. Similar thing. And so the first chamber is called the rumen, and that's where ruminants get their name. I think it's actually a Greek or Latin, like to ruminate on something means to chew on something. I think it's more of a philosophical thing in the Greek or Latin that it's meaning, where it means to like think about something for a long time, but literally it translates to chewing on something, like, but I think they meant it more as like chewing on an idea or something like that. But yeah, so they basically eat their food, they chew it up really good, and then it goes into their rumen, which ferments the food and breaks it down into more usable molecules. And it's this fermentation is what allows, you know, this plant material to actually be digested. They don't do this themselves, though. Instead, they have an enormous variety of gut microbes that do this for them. Something that we haven't really talked about much on the show at all, because it doesn't pertain all that much to paleontology, but the whole universe of gut microbiology is wild. Particularly in the last probably 4 or 5 years, we've started to learn much, much more about like our own gut microbiome, and then how that differs from all these other animals. In cows and stuff, we've known this for quite a while because of how important culturally and like economically and stuff they are to the world. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we could do a whole episode about, you know, gut flora and fauna, but that's not really going to be this episode. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they have these bacteria, and there's a huge variety of bacteria that can break down cellulose. That's how, like, when a tree dies in the forest, stuff breaks it down. Not just fungus, but also lots of bacteria. And in this chamber of the stomach, the rumen, there's lots of those bacteria, and they break it up. But something that cows in particular are very famous for doing, but all ruminants do it, is they spit back up their food after it has been fermenting for a little bit and chew on it more. And that's, if you ever heard of a cow chewing their cud, that's what mm-hmm. that is. They're chewing up their barf that has been fermenting in the first chamber of their stomach for a while.
That's a hell of a mental picture right there.
Yep. And so this, you know, it goes sort of back and forth between the rumen and their mouth a handful of times. Basically, until between the fermentation chemically breaking stuff down and then the chewing physically breaking stuff down. There's like basically a gate between the rumen and the next chamber of their stomach that is by particle size. So it's like when stuff is like a sieve, basically. So it's like when the particles get small enough, then they can move on to the next chamber of the stomach, and be, you know, digested and absorbed, like normal from there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that is by far the most efficient way that animals have sort of figured out, at least besides some of the ones that just can do it by themselves, that can break down cellulose on their own without the bacteria. This whole process of ruminating is much more efficient than any other ways, but we'll talk about a couple of the other ways. But as a little side note, this whole fermentation process is what causes cows to be a particular problem regarding climate change. Because this kind of fermentation that they do creates methane as a waste product, and they belch that out, so they just burp up methane constantly, which is not good for global warming. And
is that something that actually makes like a significant difference?
Yes.
Okay. With
like, given how many cows there are on the planet, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are billions of cows on this planet, and even if each of them all is only producing just a little methane, that's still a very noticeable amount of methane.
Okay.
So yeah, if you could take away something from this episode of the podcast, eat just even a little less beef, and that actually does make, you know, a semi-substantial difference in like your carbon footprint. Anywho, some other strategies that animals have come up with that are, you know, helpful for processing plants is what horses do. And they sort of, instead of doing it at the front of their stomach, like cows do, they ferment the mostly grass is what, you know, horses eat instead of leaves and stuff. They do it sort of at the back of their stomach or at the very start of their large intestine, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever heard the term... they're often referred to as foregut fermenters, the things that do it at the rumen, at the front of the gut, versus hindgut fermenters, things like horses, and then also things like beavers and porcupines, which actually eat a pretty substantial amount of tree bark. They do this as well toward the back end of their intestines. Rabbits do this as well, but they also do a different thing. Rabbits will eat mostly hay or grass, and then they'll poop it out, and then they'll eat their poop to run it through the wash a second time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's something that, yeah, if you have like a pet rabbit, it's actually, you kind of have to keep their poop there with them, or they won't get enough nutrients. So you can't just have like your rabbit. I think most people like litter box train their rabbits when they're kept as pets. But yeah, you usually have to somehow keep some of their poop in there with them, or it's harder for them, to get all of the nutrients they need. You still can do it, but it's keeping rabbits is kind of tricky in that way. Birds do it completely differently. They will sometimes swallow stones. They'll just swallow little pebbles, and they have this special part of their esophagus called the crop, or sometimes called the gizzard as well. Mm-hmm. And especially the ones that eat like seeds or some of the tougher plant material, they'll have these rocks that just stay in their gizzard, and as they just sort of move around, the rocks will rub together and sort of crush up the seeds or other plant material that they eat, and that's how they break it up, because birds famously don't have teeth to chew on stuff. So that is what the turkey gizzard that, you know, you take out of the turkey if you're a normal person at Thanksgiving. In the past, we won't talk too much about dinosaurs in this episode, but it is very notable that many, many groups of dinosaurs have been found with rocks inside their chest cavity as well, that are very smooth from rubbing up against each other, so it's been very confidently inferred that dinosaurs did this as well. And in particular, a group that is just amazing in everything they do is the sauropod dinosaurs. These are the giant ones with the long necks and the long tails. Littlefoot from, I'm blanking, Land Before Time.
I was just about to say that was the dinosaur one.
Yep, right? Yep. So these guys, one of the hypotheses for how they got so big and what the heck they were doing with such a long neck was that they could just stand in one spot and then just hoover up all of the plant material within reach with that long neck without moving at all. So they could just keep their body where it is, a very energy efficient way to get your food. And then they would take, 20, 30 steps to the next spot and then hoover up all of that, those plants. There's a technical term, which I thought was fun for, basically the range of that you're able to reach for food without moving is called your feeding envelope. So that was
what?
Feeding envelope.
Okay.
Yep. So if you are like me, I'm sitting at a desk right now, your feeding envelope is just like the distance you can reach with your arms right now. And so the thought is that sauropods, in order to get to such a gigantic size, in the scale of 70 to 80 tons, pushing 100 feet long, is that they grew this really long neck to, expand their feeding envelope in a way that allowed them to get to such size without spending a ton of energy and an unreasonable amount of energy. But regardless, as I mentioned earlier, whether they're mammals, birds, dinosaurs, whatever, all vertebrates use this strategy of basically co-opting microbes that do the digesting for us. And this is also the case in humans as well. We have microbes that if you eat broccoli, the microbes, you chew it up and then the microbes break it down for you. Mm-hmm. Invertebrates, on the other hand, are, as always, a bit more complicated. Most notably insects, because most other groups of invertebrates are not terribly herbivorous. There are some like snails that eat a lot of algae, but insects are the ones that have been studied the most. So some, like lots of caterpillars, don't seem to use microbes at all. They seem to just be able to do it themselves. And in fact, in some of the papers that I read, it seemed like the guts of many caterpillars are antimicrobial and actually kill bacteria. So, interesting. Some use a combination of bacteria and fungi like we vertebrates do. Like, for example, yeast is just naturally found in, like, cow stomachs and stuff. That is one of the microbes that break down the cellulose for us. Have evolved their own enzymes to break down cellulose, mainly things like termites and grasshoppers and some of their relatives and some beetles. So, for example, the caterpillars, they kind of just seem to bulk feed, where they just eat and eat and eat, and just through sheer volume and also not needing all that much food, they can just get past the inefficiency by sheer volume. Very much a quantity over quality. Whereas things like termites, which is particularly why it's so bad for to have termites like in your, you know, house or anything, they just naturally have the enzymes to be able to break down the cellulose themselves. That's why they're so good at infesting wood in particular. Some beetle larvae that have been experimented on, it seems that they don't necessarily make it themselves, so it's kind of hit or miss whether they make it themselves or they eat fungus that's just on whatever they're eating, and instead of like having the fungus live inside of it, they'll kill the fungus too, but then they'll steal the fungus's enzymes and use them to break down the cellulose. They've done experiments where the beetles are in a completely fungus-free environment, like a lab environment, and they cannot break down the cellulose. But if there is some fungus around, they can do it half on their own. Which is not, like, unheard of at all in animals. A lot, especially a lot of invertebrates do that. Or just, like, stealing chemicals from the things that you eat. That's why poison dart frogs are poisonous, because they eat insects that are highly toxic. There are even some snakes that eat toads that are toxic and use that as poison. There's even a species of snake that is both poisonous and venomous. So if it bites you, you'll get hurt. And if you bite it, you'll also get hurt because it steals the poison from the toads that it eats. So that is not at all an uncommon thing for animals to sort of steal different chemicals from their food that would be noxious that they use to then make themselves kind of noxious. But all this to say, there are very few animals that can break down cellulose by themselves. They need these bacteria and fungi in their guts to do it for them. And so far, other than the brief mention of things like corals and jellyfish and anemones and stuff, it's been a very terrestrial-focused discussion. But that's mostly because plants don't typically live fully in the water. Especially in the oceans, it's kind of just seagrass. Is like the main one, and even then, seagrass can only be found in water depths of like not more than like 30 or 40 feet. So, herbivory naturally just kind of happens less in the oceans because, as I mentioned earlier, there are not plants to eat.
Right.
However, there is lots of photosynthetic bacteria, which are different, you know, floating algae or things like that. So it's kind of hard. Some of them do have cellulose in their cell walls. Others make sort of their own cell wall out of silica or basically glass, which is just not digestible by basically anything. Some make it out of calcium carbonate, the same thing as like clamshell material, which dissolves pretty easily in even a weaker acid. So as always, in the oceans, things just get more complicated.
yes.
But there are a handful of mostly herbivorous species of fish that do kind of focus on these algae. They also seem to have a symbiotic bacteria relationship going on, but don't seem to make very effective use of the cellulose. Their poop is still very full of cellulose, so they clearly don't break it down all that much. But it's also kind of thought that this cellulose in their guts that they maybe purposefully don't break it down, because in fish, it is regulating your ammonia levels is very important. That is a waste product of respiration, just breathing, or, you know, taking in oxygen. So ammonia, the like same thing you'd use to clean, is really easily taken care of when you're on land. You just sort of pee it out. But when you're in the water, well, if you pee it out, you're still surrounded then by your pee and can take that back in. The cellulose is somehow thought to sort of bind some of this ammonia and help regulate it within the fish. I saw some stuff about that, didn't particularly understand it, but thought it was worth mentioning. for the most part, though, herbivorous things that live in the oceans are invertebrates, mostly things like sea urchins and stuff. And those also, similar to some of the insects, just seem to be able to break down cellulose on their own. Tried to look up anything about the evolution of that. Couldn't really find much because, surprise, enzymes and proteins and things don't, you know, fossilize particularly well. So that is the main problem with why it's hard to eat plants. That's, you know, step number one. But animals seem to have gotten through that relatively well. The next part comes, you know, not necessarily a sort of an accident, because plants, it's not like they use the cellulose like as a defense. That's just what they use to build themselves up off the ground. But also, plants generally don't like to be eaten. That's pretty bad for them. So,
isn't there any reason why a plant would want to get eaten? Because it also helps them, like
fruit,
spread a seed and reproduce. Like, is that
that's
like the, a possible knock on effect?
Yeah, that's the only purpose of fruit, actually.
Okay,
is to be eaten, and that's why fruit generally don't have this problem. That's why the inside sort of meat of like an apple is much easier to like chew than like a stick of celery or something.
Okay.
It's because it's supposed to be eaten. That's the entire evolutionary purpose of fruit just existing at all. But otherwise, no. There's not a whole lot of other reasons a plant would want to be eaten. And so, because of that, they have a variety of defenses about against being eaten, both physical and chemical. We'll start with some of the physical ones. These are things that are probably relatively obvious. Things like thorns, spines, or prickles, which is the technical name of things on roses, because they sort of snap off. So fun fact, every rose does not have its thorn. They are called prickles. Fun fact.
Prickles.
Yes. Things like acacia trees, which are... very well known from like the African savanna, places like that. They have enormous spines, like several inches long, because they need to defend themselves against things like elephants. Many plants on their leaves also have these little tiny hairs that are sort of irritating to the skin of vertebrates, or if, you know, whatever invertebrate is trying to eat them is small enough, it just sort of gets in the way and tangles them up so that they can't eat if they're worried about being stuck. Many develop some kind of waxes to make their leaves or stems kind of slippery and harder to sort of grab onto to eat. Many species of grasses incorporate silica crystals into their cell walls, which are basically these little tiny shards of glass. They help give them structural support, sort of like the cellulose does, but mostly also compression resistance, which helps against herbivory. And it also comes with the handy side effect of wearing down the herbivore teeth significantly over time, because it's literal glass, which causes them to die quicker because they can't chew anymore because they have no more teeth left, and then they starve to death. That's why way back in the horses episode, horses have very long, very, very tall teeth to have more of a grinding surface, because their food is basically just like eating sand. Which wears down your teeth pretty quickly, as you could imagine. And also, many plants also will purposefully make one part of their body extra tasty, fruit, so that an herbivore will be more tempted to eat that instead of the more useful parts. So that's just some of the physical stuff. The chemical stuff, though, is where plants get intense. And this is kind of why, as I've mentioned many times, I'm a little bit afraid of plants. I don't like them.
yes, as you've made clear several times.
Yeah. So the chemical defenses in plants, they vary wildly. And they can be as simple as something like capsaicin, which is the chemical in peppers that makes them spicy. This whole group of capsaicins... are really only detectable by mammals. Birds don't have a receptor to this. And so most peppers are dispersed by birds, preferentially, which is nice because you want birds to eat your seeds and then fly far away to drop your seeds off somewhere else. Birds also, like I mentioned earlier in the episode, don't have teeth, so they don't chew up the seeds and harm them, whereas if a mammal eats it, they're going to chew it up and destroy the seed. So this is a very mammal-specific chemical defense that makes them not taste good. And humans are just crazy and are like, ooh, I like pain. And I'm going to continue to eat this thing that the plant is like screaming at me, hey, don't eat me. I will hurt you. And humans are just like, I like it though. but yeah, capsaicin is meant to taste bad, but not, no, very importantly, not kill the animal, because, you know, even there's even a slight chance that, you know, your seed will be passed through the mammal. Killing the mammal doesn't really get you anywhere. So capsaicin is a deterrent, not lethal, really. Many other varieties of plant have something similar to this, where it's just a very bitter taste. Most of these bitter chemicals, though, are actually quite harmful or even potentially deadly. So, for example, some plant toxins that have this bitter taste usually interrupt the ATP pathways in cells, which ATP is what your mitochondria make, and that's basically the energy currency for your body. So if you can't make ATP because of one of these toxins, your body's just going to shut down. Some of these toxins are the same shape as certain hormones and will bind to their receptors. For example, things like adrenaline is a hormone. There are plant toxins that bind to adrenaline receptors, and so your body just can't accept adrenaline anymore. Others will bind to DNA and change its shape, potentially just giving the herbivore cancer. So, here are a couple of the very famous plant toxins that humans have figured out some other way to use. Caffeine is a toxic stimulant that can mess with many parts of the body in large quantities, particularly the heart. As anyone who's been following the Panera lemonade situation probably knows.
Oh, good God. I can't believe we were able to work that into this.
Yep. God, it's been so interesting just following that situation, but we're not going to talk about it. But yeah, caffeine is extraordinarily dangerous in large enough quantities. Another natural plant toxin is nicotine, which, on top of being one of the most addictive substances that we've ever found, in high doses, can cause seizures and also heart problems. Then that's aside from all the other bad things that tobacco does to your body. Just the nicotine by itself can just give you seizures in high enough doses. Another completely naturally occurring plant toxin is morphine. And that can cause you to lose control of some of your muscles, particularly your diaphragm muscle, which controls your lungs. So you just stop breathing. That's basically what an opioid overdose is, or at least, you know, part of it. Another one is the whole group of chemicals called cyanides, which stop your mitochondria from working correctly. And then, like I mentioned before, with interrupting the ATP pathways, your body just kind of shuts down. And that's what cyanide does. All of those are completely naturally occurring in plants that they use to keep things from eating them. Plants are pretty metal.
Yeah. Which it sort of begs the question why you don't like them if they can be so metal, but I mean, they're just so far afield from what you normally talk about.
Oh, I think they're super interesting. They're just way more complicated than mammal or than, well, mammals especially, but than animals. You know, as I've mentioned before, plants sometimes just from like, you know, one generation to the next will just like double their genome. And if that happens in an animal, the animal doesn't survive. But in plants, that's totally fine. That's totally fine. And that doesn't seem to interrupt their life in any way, and I don't understand that at all. But, yeah. So, going back to the actual herbivores here, obviously, with these are some of the extremes on plant defenses. So, many plants have sort of much more watered-down versions of some of these defenses. in some form or another. And herbivores obviously need some kind of way around these defenses, otherwise they wouldn't be able to eat the plants. And the main one, it just sort of starts with picking your target. Most herbivores are somewhat picky in which plants they'll actually eat. So if you don't eat the tobacco plants, the nicotine can't kill you. It's pretty simple. You know, similar to the physical defenses as well. If you don't eat the acacia tree leaves, the spines won't stab you, etc. Right. After you pick your target, then you sort of need to figure out some way to get past its defenses. This is where sort of the evolution takes place, and herbivores adapt to get through some of these defenses. That's not to say nothing eats acacias. You know, I think giraffes are pretty well known for eating acacias. I think they have like a very, this like skin on the roof of their mouth and their tongue is like very thick, so they can just kind of chew their way through the pain. stuff like that. But some other examples are a very similar thing that I just mentioned with giraffes was with camels. Cactus spines, you know, if you're an herbivore living in deserts, you cannot be all that picky about what you eat because you might not find another plant for a day or two and you need food.
Right.
So camels just have really thick tissue on the inside of their mouths and they just chew through the spines of cactus. Many herbivores have chemicals in their stomachs that partially detoxify some of the poisons that the plants use. Some have modified their, you know, regular stomach enzymes or potentially the bacteria in their stomach have evolved, you know, different enzymes. Because while the animals are evolving as well, the bacteria in the stomach are also evolving. It's a very complex evolutionary relationship between your gut microbe evolution and, you know, the evolution of the actual animal that they live in. Very interesting. But yeah, they can sort of neutralize some of these poisons. Some have evolved enzymes to just sort of encapsulate the poison molecules. And so they just sort of put them in a little bubble and they just pass right through the gut undigested. Some do things way simpler and just produce a lot of saliva, a lot of spit, just to water down the amount of toxins, you know, per milliliter that they're actually eating.
Mm-hmm.
Can be as simple as that. As I mentioned, though, for the most part, it is pretty much just the microbes doing a lot of the heavy lifting here. And there is so much more to say about this whole interesting predator-prey relationship between plants and herbivores, because that's really what it is. The same way that, you know, gazelles and cheetahs have been evolving to just be faster and faster to try to outrun each other. Very similar evolutionary, you know, arms race between herbivores and the plants that they eat. Because to a plant, an herbivore is a predator, not just the thing that the lion eats. So they also, there's so much interesting to talk about this evolutionary relationship that we don't have as much time to get into. Now for this last sort of segment of the podcast, let's actually talk about some paleontology on this paleontology podcast. So let's sort of start by talking about marine ecosystems in the time before life came onto land. So way, way, way back in the day. At first, there were no true plants in the ocean, just algae, things like kelp. So like maybe like macroalgae, large, very plant-like, if you've ever seen kelp, but kelp is not a plant.
I was going to ask why they're not plants, but maybe that's a story for another time.
Yeah. Some technical distinctions. Mostly it's like a phylogenetics thing where it's like they don't, just like evolutionarily, they fall outside mm-hmm. of the most recent common ancestor of all the plants. I think they're very close, though.
Understood.
Or even just things like microalgae on top of these larger algae like kelp. So just things floating around in the water doing photosynthesis. Naturally, that's part of any marine or even like a lake ecosystem. Doing the similar things of most primary producers where they're taking in the sunlight, doing photosynthesis, doing their thing. Most of them at this time were single-celled, typically had less cellulose than we see in, you know, like land plants. Because, as I mentioned, the whole reason cellulose really is a thing is to give the cells in the plant structure. And if you're in the water, you don't really need structure because the water supports you by itself. You don't need, you know, that's why, you know, really squishy things can't really live on land because they don't have any way to support themselves. But a jellyfish is perfectly fine in the water. So there was just naturally less cellulose to go around. And that was sort of the case for the very early part of complex ecosystems, mostly in the Cambrian period, give or take 550 million years ago through closer to 500 million years ago. However, once life moves up onto land, things don't sort of change right away. The first, you know, multicellular things to come up onto land was plants. Plants much more like mosses, very simple plants. They come up onto land in the mid-Ordovician period, around 470 million years ago. And within a few tens of millions of years, the first vascular plants evolve. Things like simple ferns or quillworts or another group of modern plants that are pretty quote-unquote primitive. But the first plants with actual like tubes in them to run, you know, materials from one end of the plant to another. Mosses don't really have that. And by the middle Silurian to the early Devonian, plants were forming very short, forest-like ecosystems, maybe a few inches tall, somewhere in the ballpark of 430 to 400 million years ago. So from the time they come up onto land, nearly 100 million years later, we have very teeny tiny little forest.
That's a fun way to put it.
Yeah, because they were, you know, there were different species of plants, all at sort of varying different little heights. The tallest one still not being more than a few inches long, but sort of layered like you would think in a forest. Mm-hmm. By around this same time, though, you know, early 400s to about 400 million years ago, arthropods were coming up onto land as well. But many were likely still eating each other. Some of the first arthropod or terrestrial arthropod fossils that we see are things like scorpions and spiders, which are almost universally carnivorous. I think there's like a single species of herbivorous spider across, you know, hundreds and hundreds of species. And I don't think there's any non-carnivorous scorpions. I think they're all universally carnivorous.
Really?
Yeah. And so they likely were just coming up onto land to escape things trying to eat them in the water. Until some of the... There was one group that is today all universally herbivorous that was around at this time too, and those were things like millipedes. We have some millipedes at the time, so these all started to come up at roughly the same time. So there is the very beginnings of some kind of modern ecosystem dynamic where there's just kind of a couple of things eating plants at this time, but things still mostly eating other animals. And so plants were basically on land for over 20 million years before things were around to eat them, which is kind of mind-boggling to me. Throughout this time, after arthropods sort of come up onto land, they continue to diversify for millions of years and were the only herbivores for a very long period of time. Again, pretty much just millipedes. The ancestors of insects were starting to come around at this time as well. And again, just barely starting to dabble into herbivory. But the first vertebrates to be very adapted to life on land were very salamander-like. So imagine just like a vague salamander shape, but, you know, sometimes quite large, you know, 6 or 7 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of the Devonian period, somewhere around 380, 370 million years. So this is give or take 50 million years after what we were just talking about with the first arthropods coming onto land. But at this point, all vertebrates still predatory. they were just coming up, eating each other. Because, you know, salamanders as well can, you know, function pretty well on land and in the water. So they just had more opportunity to eat any other animal. And it wasn't until the late Carboniferous period, maybe into the early Permian period, that vertebrates started to dabble into herbivory. So that's around 300 million years ago. Basically, arthropods were the only herbivores for about 70 to 80 million years.
Hmm. And that seems like a long time. Like,
yeah.
I get something always has to be the first, but that seems like a long time for something to be the only one.
Yeah. Well, if you're just sort of getting... you have to get past that initial hurdle where it's like, well, if I can't digest plants at all yet, there's really not a selection pressure to try eating a plant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, I guess that makes sense.
So, but once that hurdle was sort of crossed for the first time, you know, it sort of explodes. And if you think about that, selection pressure to become herbivorous is pretty obvious. It's a food source that by this point, you know, the Carboniferous is famous for having giant rainforests. By this point, we went, you know, as I mentioned, a couple inch tall forests to, by this point, there were trees hundreds of feet tall. There were, you know, full, especially during the sort of mid Carboniferous, the entire land was covered by rainforest. So plants were abundant, were doing great. So the selection pressure to become herbivorous was very obvious. No other vertebrates are eating this food source that is covering the literal entire planet. So if nobody else is eating it, that's more food for me.
Yeah, the market inefficiency.
Exactly. Unfortunately, toward the end of the Carboniferous, that is when Pangaea starts to form. And as we've talked about, when Pangaea forms, the middle of Pangaea is just so far from the oceans that it becomes basically a giant desert. Mm-hmm. And so the rainforests of the Carboniferous did not last all that long. But by the start of the Permian, some of the first groups of herbivorous vertebrates were around. And while we'll never truly know the answer, the biggest question around this is, how did vertebrates first start getting these bacteria in our guts to allow us to break down cellulose? And we'll never really know, because just the nature of fossils is that we very rarely get gut contents of animals, that is, like the bones or, you know, chewed up plant material of something that was eaten. If that's incredibly rare to begin with, we're definitely never going to get fossilized gut bacteria. That just doesn't happen, and likely will never happen given how old this is.
Mm-hmm.
But as always in paleontology, we do have some generally educated guesses, or hypotheses, as they're known in the biz. There's a couple of different thoughts. The one that seemed the most likely to me is that there was a group, or more likely several different groups, you know, because by this point, reptiles had split off to their own thing. Mammal ancestors, the synapsids, had split off to do their own thing. So likely several different groups started off insectivorous, eating all the different bugs and stuff that could digest cellulose. And by eating them, we also ate their gut bacteria. And then over time, the gut bacteria, you know, maybe in just one particular, you know, animal, their gut was more hospitable to those same gut bacteria that were just not, you know, dying after being eaten when the insect was eaten. And they just sort of hung out and basically went from insectivorous to omnivorous, eating insects and also maybe the leaf that the insect was on as well. And then that sort of slow transition from insectivory to omnivory to full herbivory. That is pretty much the only super viable seeming pathway that I could find is that they basically just stole the gut microbes from the bugs. And this whole, however it happened, this kicked off basically everything of how modern ecosystems work. Because at this point, we've had plants evolving, you know, new ways to get past being eaten by these invertebrates. But now, this kicks off plants evolving to not only get past the invertebrates, but also now the vertebrates. And then the vertebrates re-evolving new ways to get past the new defenses that the plants have evolved. And then while all that's happening, you have the carnivores over off on their side, evolving new ways to eat the herbivores. And that basically kicks off everything that we understand about modern ecosystems can really be traced back to this evolution of herbivory in sort of the early Permian period, you know, almost 300 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, we're just kind of off to the races. There was a class that I took in grad school that was terrestrial paleoecology. And
that sounds like a real barn burner.
I liked it. It was.
I know you liked it. That was never a question.
Well, that class in particular was kind of interesting because we're kind of drifting away from the topic here a little bit. But I took that class with one of my professors was also a PhD student in our department, and so he took that class while I was TAing for him in one of his other classes. So it simultaneously one semester, he was my classmate and also kind of my boss. It was a little weird, especially when I think that semester, that class only had like four people in it. But yeah, anyway, we talked a little bit about, you know, the Carboniferous and the Devonian periods, but it's like, well, ecosystems back then were just really bizarre because of how little herbivorous activity there was. And it's not until the Permian where things start to look even a little bit like they do today.
Right.
And yeah, I guess from this point, see any of our episodes talking about the individual periods as we're inching ever closer to the modern day. We just had our episode about the Paleocene epic a couple episodes ago. So yeah. That's kind of all I got. Do you have any last burning questions about how to eat a plant?
Should I be a vegetarian? And give me a yes or no. I don't want any of this middle of the road nonsense.
So, I can't say yes because I'm not. I have tried it, and it was actually going quite well, and then COVID lockdown happened, and I was like, you know what, I could really use a burger right now.
Yep. I know that feeling.
Yep. And so I was for probably close to a year. But so
wow, how old were you? So that was right before COVID.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think COVID, we all needed a couple of good burgers.
Yep. So I'm going to say no, even though the answer should be yes. But
if you can pull it off, great. But if not, don't feel too bad about yourself.
Right. Just eat more chicken and a little less beef. That's, yeah.
And on that note, thank you everybody for listening to episode 127 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. We hope you have a wonderful holiday and a nice new year. And we'll see all of you guys in that new year. Until then, take care, everybody.
This episode of I Wish You Were Dead was written by Gavin Davidson and hosted by Gavin Davidson, Mike Bryson, and Fenella Campanino. It was sound edited and edited for YouTube by Gavin Davidson. Special thanks to former guests of the pod and to listeners like you.